Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This has been a long and incredible haul, and may this deal be done. We have worked hard. The feet of our feet on the streets, and I think it's really set the tone for other workers in America and other unions.
After 146 days on strike, a tentative deal has been reached between writers and the Hollywood studios. The Writers Guild of America's described the new deal as exceptional. We'll get the latest and get an update on auto workers expanding their strike against the Big Three. Then Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas is facing new scrutiny after ProPublica revealed he secretly participated in at least two donor fundraising events organized by a right-wing network founded by the Koch brothers.
The Koch political network has brought multiple cases to the Supreme Court, including one of the most closely watched of the upcoming term. And Justice Thomas's appearance at these donor events was not previously disclosed.
And New Jersey Democratic Senator Robert Menendez has been indicted along with his wife for allegedly accepting large bribes to benefit the Egyptian government.
Special agents with the FBI executed search warrants on the residence and safe deposit box of Senator Menendez and Nadine Menendez in New Jersey. When they got there, they discovered approximately $500,000 of cash stuffed into envelopes and closets. Some of the cash was stuffed in the senator's jacket pockets.
We'll go to Cairo and New Jersey for the latest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy and a growing number of Democrats are calling on New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez to resign after he and his wife were indicted Friday on bribery charges. Congressmember Andy Kim announced Saturday he'll run for Menendez's Senate seat. Federal prosecutors accuse Menendez of accepting bribes in exchange for using his position to increase U.S. assistance to Egypt and to do favors for New Jersey businessmen.
Senator Menendez allegedly provided sensitive, non-public U.S. government information to Egyptian officials and otherwise took steps to secretly aid the government of Egypt. We also allege that Senator Menendez improperly pressured a senior official at the U.S. Department of Agriculture to protect a lucrative monopoly that the government of Egypt had awarded to Hana, a lucrative monopoly that Hana then used to fund certain bribe payments.
Bribes included a Mercedes-Benz, mortgage payments, gold bars, and over $500,000 in cash stashed throughout the house. It's the second time Menendez has been charged with corruption. Menendez stepped down as chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's holding a press conference today. We'll have more on the story later in the broadcast. The Writers Guild of America has reached what union leaders are calling an exceptional tentative deal on a new contract with Hollywood studios and streaming services after a historic 146-day strike. The settlement follows stepped-up negotiations over the past week between the WGA and the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, capping months of stalled talks over compensation, residuals, and protections against artificial intelligence. The writers' breakthrough could give momentum to talks between SAG-AFTRA and Hollywood studios to end a strike by actors who walked off the job in July. In other labor news, President Biden will walk the picket line with United Auto Workers in Michigan Tuesday. It's believed to be the first time a sitting president has joined strikers on the picket line. This comes as the union announced Friday an expansion of its strike to 38 locations in 20 states. The new work stoppages target GM and Stellantis after the UAW acknowledged real progress in talks with Ford. French President Emmanuel Macron announced Sunday France will withdraw its troops and ambassador from Niger 2 months after a military coup that overthrew President Mohamed Bazoum. It's another setback for France's waning presence in the Sahel region, where its decades-long counterterrorism efforts have largely failed or worsened insecurity. Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, all former French colonies, have seen military coups in recent years, formed a mutual defense pact earlier this month to combat against armed interventions. In Somalia, at least 21 people were killed and more than 50 others wounded Saturday as a truck loaded with explosives sped through a security checkpoint and detonated in a residential neighborhood of the central Somali town of Beledweyne. The blast reduced buildings and shops to rubble. No one's claimed responsibility, though the Al-Shabaab armed group has been active in the area. The attack came one day before U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed in Djibouti, where Austin praised Somalia's military for what he called its impressive progress in the fight against al-Shabaab. Austin is in Nairobi, Kenya today and will visit Angola later in the week. In Ghana, hundreds of people took to the streets for 3 days of anti-government protests as anger mounts over skyrocketing living costs and unemployment.
This is very, very dangerous to the whole country. We have kids among the age of 14, 15, who are now taking people's belongings just to survive. The government that doesn't care, they are just selling money. And the African can't do nothing, but their time is up. We are here and we will fight. If no one cares, the youth cares. And when the youth cares, then the country must care.
It's the worst economic crisis to hit Ghana in years, triggered by the pandemic, the war in Ukraine, and rising debt to the International Monetary Fund after Ghana's government agreed to a $3 billion loan. At least 49 people were arrested in the capital Accra Thursday as police blocked protesters from storming the presidential palace. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers killed two Palestinians during a military raid on a refugee camp in the city of Tulkarem. This is the brother of 32-year-old Abdurrahman Abu Dakhash, killed by Israeli forces Sunday.
First of all, I was with my brother here. He went up to the rooftop to film the ambulances. He barely had a chance to look, and a sniper targeted him. He has nothing to do with it. He has children, and his wife is about to give birth. He had nothing to do with it, and he was unarmed.
The latest violence in the West Bank came as Israel's military launched more airstrikes on the Gaza Strip over the weekend. As Palestinians continue to protest Israel shutting down the Beit Hanun crossing, the only operational crossing for Gazans to enter Israel, including some 18,000 Palestinians who work in Israel. Canada's House Speaker Anthony Rota has apologized for leading a standing ovation for a 98-year-old Ukrainian veteran who fought alongside the Nazis. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who was at the Canadian Parliament to deliver an address to the lawmakers, joined in on the applause, along with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. It's not clear if Zelensky, who is Jewish, knew that Yaroslav Honka was a member of SS Galashina, which was found to be responsible for the persecution and extermination of Jews during the Nuremberg trials. Zelensky has previously spoken out against the Nazi unit. In more news from Canada, the New York Times is reporting U.S. spies provided information to the Canadian government that helped lead to the claim India was directly involved in the June killing of Sikh separatist leader Hardeep Singh Nijjar in British Columbia. But the Times says Ottawa's own surveillance of Indian diplomats in Canada provided the most definitive evidence to support its accusation, which India has rejected. Following Nijjar's assassination, the FBI warned Sikh activists in the United States of possible death threats. Thousands of ethnic Armenians are fleeing the breakaway region of Nagorno-Karabakh following Azerbaijan's 24-hour military operation last week, which seized control of the disputed territory from Armenian separatist forces. One survivor said shelling by Azerbaijani forces on his village left dozens of civilians dead.
We barely survived the last days. It was scary. There was shelling from all sides. There were dead bodies. I don't know where they are now. Two refrigerated trucks filled with bodies to the top, and there's no place to even bury them. Out of 500 residents in my settlement, only 40 managed to get out. Everyone else stayed. They are at the airport and in the city, in different places, and they are waiting to be evacuated.
Over the weekend, Armenia asked the United Nations for help monitoring the rights of ethnic Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh. Armenia's prime minister said he needed guarantees from Azerbaijan that civilians would be protected.
Unless real living conditions are created for the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh in their homes and effective mechanisms of protection from ethnic cleansing, then the likelihood that the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh will see exile from their homeland as the only way to preserve their lives and identity increases significantly.
Meanwhile, protesters in Armenia continue to demand the prime minister resign for failing to support Armenian separatists in Nagorno-Karabakh. In Kosovo, ethnic Serb gunmen in armored vehicles ambushed a police patrol and stormed a monastery near the border with Serbia Sunday, beginning a chaotic day of violence that ended with at least four people killed. Many of the gunmen escaped. Kosovo's prime minister, Albin Kurti, accused Serbia's government of financing and motivating the attackers. Kosovo declared independence in 2008, but the Serbian government does not recognize that sovereignty. Serbian president Aleksandar Vučić blamed Prime Minister Kurti for provoking the assailants.
He left Kosovo Serbs to worry about their future, and all the time he kept provoking them. I regret that some Serbs succumbed to the provocations. Albin Kurti is the only one to blame. Albin Kurti is the only one who wants conflict and war. No other man wants conflict and war besides him. His life's desire is to drag us into war with NATO.
In Nebraska, a woman who pleaded guilty to helping her 17-year-old daughter obtain abortion pills, then helping her dispose of the fetus, was sentenced to 2 years in prison Friday. Jessica Burgess admitted in July to helping with the abortion when her daughter Celeste was 29 weeks pregnant in April 2022. At the time, Nebraska still allowed abortions up to 20 weeks. Celeste Burgess had already received a 90-day sentence after taking a plea deal and was released from jail in early September. And Pope Francis is calling for international action to stop the drowning of refugees as they attempt to reach European shores. During his visit to Marseille, France, Pope Francis said the Mediterranean Sea, quote, has become a huge cemetery where many brothers and sisters are deprived even of the right to a grave.
We should not get used to seeing disasters at sea as mere news stories and those dying at sea as numbers. No, they have names, faces, and stories. They are broken lives and shattered dreams.
The UN has recorded some 25,000 drownings in the Mediterranean since 2014, though the true death toll is likely much higher. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. After 146 days on strike, the Writers Guild of America and the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers have announced a tentative deal has been reached between striking writers and the studios. The Writers Guild's negotiating committee told union members, quote, we can say with great pride that this deal is exceptional, with meaningful gains and protections for writers in every sector of the membership, they said. The deal includes many of the demands of the striking writers, including higher pay and residual payments for streaming content and new rules about the use of artificial intelligence. The WGA leadership is expected to vote on the deal Tuesday. The strike, which began May 2nd, had largely shut down the production of movies and scripted TV shows. The tentative agreement does not impact actors who have been on strike since July 14th. We're joined now by labor reporter Alex Press, staff writer for Jacobin Magazine, who's closely covered the writer's strike. Alex, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you explain what we understand at this point are the major issues that have been resolved, and then what is the timetable for how this strike ends?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Amy, on such a positive occasion for a change. So as you said in your introduction here, you know, we don't know much about the details. Descriptions of the deal right now, the tentative agreement, which, again, will have to be voted on by the membership after being approved of by both the boards on both the Writers Guild of America West and East. So it'll take a few days for that vote to happen. That deal apparently includes protections around the use of artificial intelligence, which writers were worried would be used to be trained on their old scripts, to basically use their former work to train them out of future work. There are concerns around the lack of residuals in streamers. So if you're on Netflix, you know, it's not like the writer is getting another payment every time there's a rerun. There's no such thing as a rerun. You can watch Seinfeld all day long on Netflix. So there is apparently a new form of residual that's going to come in the form of some bonus of some sort. The details are scarce. You know, I spoke with some bargaining committee members late last night, and they said, we're still respecting the press blackout. So they are not speaking. They are waiting for the process to go forward in the union. And that process is as followed, right? So the negotiating committee is going to vote on whether to recommend this tentative agreement. They're going to then send it to the board of both the East and West, WGA. Those elected bodies of leadership are then going to vote on whether to authorize the membership to ratify the contract, right? So there's a couple steps here before members are voting. You know, their elected leadership, both West and East, are going to look at the details once those details are finalized and make sure that this is good enough for them to even send it to the membership, right? So, you know, I often say that unions are one of the few democratic institutions the working class in this country still have. And it's great that they actually get to enjoy those processes that, you know, are about their say and their elected leaders' say. So it's not a done deal yet. And as you mentioned, SAG-AFTRA members have yet to even meet once with the AMPTP. We can expect that that will happen soon, but, you know, never a done deal in Hollywood at this point.
And just to be clear, does the membership have to vote before? I mean, there's been speculation that, for example, the late night talk shows might be starting as early as tomorrow night or the next night. Do they have to finally vote before that happens?
As far as I know, that is not going to happen. You know, the WGA negotiating committee was very clear that until they say so, all members in this covered under this contract are on strike. And so just because they've suspended those picket lines does not mean workers are going back into the offices or the proverbial writers' rooms that might happen remotely. So I don't know if there's any speculation or something on that, but nothing I've seen from the WGA suggests that members are to report to work.
So let's turn to the United Auto Workers strike targeting the big three automakers. On Friday, the UAW expanded the strike to 38 GM and Stellantis parts distribution centers. The strike did not include any new Ford locations. Meanwhile, President Biden's planning to join the United Auto Workers picket line in Michigan on Tuesday, believed to be the first time a sitting president has joined strikers on the picket line. Donald Trump is planning to visit Detroit on Wednesday, so it looks like Biden wanted to get in there before that. Though whether or not Trump will walk the picket line, he is fiercely criticizing the UAW leadership. President Biden's expressed support. Alex, can you talk about the expansion and what it means for a president? It's funny to say a sitting president walking the line, but it'll be the walking president.
A standing up president, as President Sean Fain would put it, president of the UAW, that is. Yeah, I mean, this is really a product very clearly and unambiguously of the union being militant rather than deferential, not just to Biden, but to any politician. You know, the UAW has been very clear. Anyone is invited to stand in solidarity on the picket line with the membership. And it's a huge win that Biden feels that it's necessary. Certainly, I would say about Donald Trump, you know, President Sean Fain has been very clear that this membership and this strike is all about putting an end to the redistribution of wealth upward to billionaires and millionaires. And I think he brooks, you know, no interest in Donald Trump's pretend interest in the working class. And, you know, I think it's very interesting that whether you look at Trump or other of the sort of faux populist right-wing thinkers and politicians, they keep pretending that they support this strike, but they seem to never add any details to that, right? You know, Biden, for his, you know, on his part, did say record profits, record contracts. You're not really seeing that from a lot of other sort of people on the right. And so I want to be clear here that this is a strike that is about higher wages, that's getting money that's owed to these workers for sacrifices they've made, particularly since the Great Recession. And it's worth saying that progress has been made at Ford, at one of the big three here. And Ford has given they've tentatively agreed to certain issues. At least that is what my understanding of the progress at that negotiating table is. And some of those things include restoring the cost of living allowances that workers gave up at Ford during the bailout and the recession. It includes converting temporary workers to permanent workers after 90 days, whereas currently it was 4 or 8 years that it took those workers to be converted. You know, these are big deal wins, and they are also things that the company said they could never do. And suddenly it didn't even take an all-out strike, and you're starting to see them do what they said was impossible.
Well, of course, we'll continue to cover all of this. Alex Press, I want to thank you for joining us for this late-breaking news. Staff writer for Jacobin Magazine, where she covers labor. Next up, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas facing new scrutiny after ProPublica reveals he secretly participated in at least 2 fundraising events organized by a right-wing network founded by the Koch brothers. Back in 30 seconds. Celebration by Kool and the Gang here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The independent news outlet ProPublica has published another damning investigation its series on the connections between Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and donors who may be impacted by cases that come before his court. That's the nation's highest court. The latest story concerns the libertarian billionaires Charles and David Koch, who've spent millions on conservative causes and funneled vast donations into Republican campaigns. The report's headline, Clarence Thomas secretly participated in Koch Network donor events, and follows up on past reports that Clarence Thomas secretly accepted luxury trips from GOP donor Harlan Crow and many others. In the new piece, ProPublica reports Justice Thomas has attended Koch donor events at least twice over the years. And, quote, that puts Thomas in the extraordinary position of having served as a fundraising draw for a network that's brought cases before the Supreme Court, including one of the most closely watched of the upcoming term, unquote. The pending Supreme Court case challenges a precedent-setting case known as Chevron and seeks to limit the power of federal agencies to issue regulations in areas ranging from the environment to labor rights to consumer protection. David Koch died in 2019. His brother, Charles Koch, did not respond to the new report. But a Koch Network spokesperson told ProPublica, quote, Thomas wasn't present for fundraising conversations. The idea that attending a couple events to promote a book or give dinner remarks, as all the justices do, could somehow be undue influence just doesn't hold water, the spokesperson said. For more on the details of this new investigation, including how Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas was at the Bohemian Grove, a secretive all-men's retreat in Northern California with David Koch and filmmaker Ken Burns, among others, we're joined by Justin Elliott, reporter for ProPublica. Welcome back, Justin, to Democracy Now! Lay out this latest expose.
Sure. So what we found is that Justice Thomas, as you mentioned, has attended and participated in multiple Koch donor summits. So essentially, the Koch brothers founded this powerful network of political groups, spends hundreds of millions of dollars on elections, also employs lawyers who bring cases to the courts. And every January, they have a big donor summit out in Palm Springs, California, where Charles Koch has a mansion. Other wealthy business people fly out there. They have a meeting. They sort of review what they've been doing. It's essentially their big marquee fundraising event of the year. And that's the event that we found Justice Thomas had made undisclosed trips to. Most recently, in January 2018, we found the justice was flown out there on a private jet, gave a talk to a small dinner of high-dollar Koch donors, people that gave over $1 million, and none of this was disclosed as it should have been on his annual financial disclosures.
I wanted to get your response to, it's rare to get these justices commenting like this, Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan giving an address at Notre Dame Law School on Friday after your new report on Justice Thomas came out. She was asked if the high court needs a code of ethics. She didn't mention Justice Thomas by name in her response.
Right now, we're in a situation where we've committed to following certain kinds of ethical rules respecting judges, but have said we will only be guided by others. So, you know, we've committed to following the gift rules that other judges follow and the outside income rules that other judges follow. But other judges have a very extensive code of ethics that governs everything that they do. And there's been some concern, and I think it's legitimate concern, that not that the Supreme Court is an unusual kind of court in certain respects, and that some of the rules do not fit quite as well at the Supreme Court level than they do at the level of lower courts. But of course, what we could do is just adapt the code of conduct that the other court systems have in order to reflect those slight or certain differences. And I think it would be a good thing for the court to do that.
So that's Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan. Justin Elliott, your response. How significant is what she's saying and how many Congress members agree with her? I want to mention that Brett Kavanaugh, the other Supreme Court justice, recently said the court may, quote, soon address a code of ethics on the high court. And Chief Justice John Roberts in May called ethics scandals at the court a, quote, issue of concern and said justices were, quote, continuing to look at things. Your response to all this?
Yeah. So first of all, just to explain, I mean, as Justice Kagan mentioned, all other federal judges below the Supreme Court level have, you know, extensive rules, a code of ethics, advisory opinions. You know, we actually quoted a retired federal judge, a George W. Bush appointee, in our new story, who said that if he had gone to a Koch donor summit, there would have been a disciplinary proceeding. And the reason for that is lower court judges are not supposed to be involved in either political events or fundraising. And this Koch donor summit is, you know, arguably both of those things. But as Justice Kagan said, those rules don't apply to the Supreme Court. I think is significant, although I will note that they've been talking about adopting some sort of formal rules for at least 5 or 6 years now. And the reporting on that is that the court is looking for unanimity among the 9 justices and apparently been having trouble getting that. So I think it's really something that if they adopt any rules, we'll really have to take a close look at them to see if there's any teeth or if it's just sort of abstractions about the importance of being independent and acting.
We just showed a picture of Ken Burns, David Koch, who has since died, and Justice Clarence Thomas. Can you talk about that gathering?
Sure. So another part of this story connects back to our previous reporting on Harlan Crow, who's a Republican billionaire political donor out of Dallas, who's been essentially subsidizing Justice Thomas's life for many decades, bringing him on expensive vacations around the world, paying tuition for relatives and other things. What we found now is that Harlan Crow has been taking Justice Thomas on more trips over the years, previously undisclosed trips, out to the Grove, which, if folks haven't heard of it, is this all men's retreat, takes place every July in a redwood forest in Sonoma County, where essentially political and corporate elites meet. You have to be a member of this club to get in. Famously, Henry Kissinger has been going for many decades. And what we found is that Justice Thomas has been going there for years. He's a regular there with Harlan Crow. And he stays in this camp, which is essentially like a fraternity with a couple dozen men. And other members of that camp include Charles and David Koch. It's called Midway. And what we were told, talking to many people that have spent time there over the years, is that the Justice developed this relationship and bond with the Kochs on these trips to the Bohemian Grove, which really answers a question in part that we've been wondering about, which is what is going on all these trips and vacations that Harlan Crow is taking Justice Thomas on. It turns out part of the answer is, you know, he's spending time with people like the Kochs who have active interests and, in fact, cases at the Supreme Court.
So if you can talk about a case that's coming up, I'm looking at one article in The Hill, Chevron case.